You're listening to Wolves Potluck.
And hey, welcome to Books and Boba, a book club and podcast featuring books by Asian and Asian American authors. My name is Marvin Yue.
And I'm Rira Yu.
And happy Lunar New Year to all of those who celebrate. And we are ringing in the Year of the Horse with an author chat with Lillian Lee, the author of past Books and Boba book club pick number one Chinese restaurant. And she joins us to talk about her latest novel, Bad Asians. As always, Books and Boba is supported in part by our listeners. So if you've been enjoying our podcast and want to become a bigger part of our book club, head on over to patreon.com/booksandboba, where as an official Patreon member, you can gain access to our members-only Discord server. We can chat about our book club picks and all sorts of other topics in real time. And if you join us at the Honey Boba level, you also gain access to our monthly bonus podcast, Boba Chats, as well as the opportunity to help us pick a quarterly Patron's Choice book club pick. So yeah, we're really excited to have Lillian on the podcast to talk about her new novel, Bad Asians. An Asian-American coming-of-age story about four friends who find themselves all moving back in with their parents after graduating college in 2008 as the global financial crisis derails all of their well-laid plans. While they're home, they're convinced to be a part of a YouTube documentary called Bad Asians, which inadvertently goes viral and ends up essentially haunting the group, as well as bringing them back together time and time again throughout their adult lives.
Yeah, so we had a great time talking to Lillian about the good old days of YouTube and the Great Recession of 2008, what it meant to survive through the recession, and having high expectations as high achieving Asians and having the American dream ripped away from them and coming of age and just a lot of things. So I hope you guys enjoy this conversation with Lillian. And we are here with Lillian Lee, the author of Number One Chinese Restaurant, which was a prior Books and Boba book club pick, and it was longlisted for the Women's Prize for Fiction. Lillian's work has been featured on The New York Times, Granta, and Hyphen. And we're here to talk about her sophomore novel, Bad Asians. Welcome to the show, Lillian.
Thank you, and happy Lunar New Year.
Yeah, happy New Year.
Happy Lunar New Year.
How does it feel to have your book launch on New Year's Day?
Amazing. It feels like very lucky, you know, but yeah. It's funny because it was a total coincidence. And I'm such a bad Asian that I didn't even notice. It was my cousin who realized that it was the day.
Oh, I know. I need to check. Like, I usually double check on like the end of January. Like, when is the New Year?
Right?
Because we need to start preparing.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I like totally forgot too. But I have the excuse of like Koreans, we don't really have that big of a celebration for Lunar New Year.
Well, you guys also don't use the lunar calendar, right?
We do use the lunar calendar. It's just that the old people use it and we
don't. You're part of the young generation.
Yeah, yeah. I don't think my parents even use it.
Yeah.
I think like my grandparents had a lunar calendar, but
wow.
Yeah, I need to make sure to pick one up from the Chinese supermarket every year because my dad still goes by lunar birthday. So his birthday changes every year. So I need to make sure, like, because he doesn't tell us because he wants us to remember. So like, you know, usually
what a power move.
Yeah. So usually it's on as the eldest brother. It's up to me to figure out the dates, like tell my brother when to call him.
Oh my God. This is very filial of you.
Yeah.
So I like to start our conversations with a little icebreaker. And since your book is about a coming of age story about four friends who are coming of age in like the early YouTube days, when virality was slowly becoming a thing in right. pop culture. So my question is, what is your favorite meme or YouTube video from the late 2000s to the early 2010s?
Well, I have to answer with Wong Fu Productions' Yellow Fever, which I know didn't originally come out on YouTube because it came out a couple of years before YouTube became mainstream. But it is like foundational to my book, but also my experience of Asian YouTubers. And I went back recently and watched it. And can you believe that it was 20 minutes long? And it went viral. Yeah. Like, it just like was a completely different like equation for virality back in the 2000s.
Yeah, this is how I know you and I are contemporaries, because I remember I went to UCSD. I was the same year as the YouTube, as the Wong Fu guys. And I remember when they first released their first cover of Qing Fei De Yi, we were sharing it on our school FTP drives. Like, we were just like sharing the link to the video. And then I remember, because we just back when AIM was how we communicate with our friends, I had friends from like UC Berkeley, Boston University, like sending me the link to their video. Like, I know this video. They're at my school, guys. But just the fact that that's how we went viral back in the day, which is like this internal like FTP. Kids these days don't even know what FTP is anymore.
I know. It feels like it used to travel like a chain letter. It's just like, if you don't send this to 10 people, you'll die. Like that. It's really wild.
I feel like for me, because I'm a little bit younger than you guys, I got introduced to Wong Fu when like YouTube did become like an official thing, and they started to upload shorts like pretty often along with like their vlogs. They were like one of the earlier vloggers in like the YouTube community, and it's just like so funny to me because they were on like a college tour and they visited my college, so like I got to meet them. And at the time I was like attending film school, and I told them like, oh, I'm studying film, like hopefully I can work with you guys in the future. And bam, I moved to LA and was literally like the first thing, first connection that I made, because I worked with ISA, and ISA was associated with Wong Fu. So I got to work on their other like short film content. So it was like, it was like really, really weird and like serendipitous. But yeah, like Wong Fu was definitely OG in like the early YouTube days.
Truly.
I have to say I like miss early YouTube because it was so chaotic and we were just throwing spaghettis at the wall. Like I remember like Potter Puppet Pals and like Chocolate Rain and the Badger song.
Yeah,
like I'm sure like, if we like say those things to like Gen Z and like Gen Alpha, they're gonna be like, what are you talking about?
Well, that stuff's coming back. They're like, it's all vintage to them now. It's like
that's true.
It's like 80, it's like 70s movies for us. It's like they're like Newgrounds is their like 70s movies.
Yeah, exactly. And like looking at the brain rot that they're like consuming, like I'm also very confused by what they're into.
Yeah, it's like strange that like TikTok is now like the king of like video like video content, and it's like back in our day we had YouTube videos that were 20 minutes long. We did not know how to market ourselves. We did not know like the data
the angles
for, yeah.
It was an innocent time.
It was a better time. Yeah.
we sound so old.
I know.
But going, you know, like we're talking about like the good old days. I want to ask you, like, how did you get started in writing? Was this something that you were always into, or was this something that you decided to pursue after college?
Yeah. Well, I started pretty young, like in elementary school, by writing fan fiction with my best friend Liz. And we wrote like Yu-Gi-Oh fan fiction, Roni Kenshin fan fiction. And that was like our access to creative writing. But it was always like a way of almost like socializing and kind of like our version of playing with dolls. Like we also played Sims and Roller Coaster Tycoon. I feel like they're all related in some way. And I continued to write fanfiction well into high school and just happened to go to a high school with a really strong creative writing department. And through just taking classes, realized that I also loved writing fiction from my life or just like fiction of my own creation. Went to a young writers workshop for the first time, realized that there were other people my age that loved to write, found a community there. Then went to college and took a lot of creative writing classes, learned about MFA programs, went to an MFA program. So, you know, I kind of just kept finding the right people at the right time that made writing feel like it was a real, if not career, then like a vocation, like something you could do with your life,
Yeah, I think that's really important. Something that we, you know, we have all sorts of, you know, we talk to primarily Asian American authors for this podcast, and there's so many different paths people take, but it all comes down to like eventually realizing that this is something that they could do, right? And some people start early. They're fortunate to have parents who were artists or creatives and nurtured that. Mm. And some people started later. And, you know, some people are just lucky enough to like have people be able to model that this is like a path that is possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally. It is like really crazy to be kind of like in some ways create the guidepost for yourself. But also if I think back to like my parents coming here in America, they also kind of did the same thing and had to figure it out along the way. So in some ways, even though I wasn't modeled like a writing career, I was modeled what it looks like to just do your own thing with no one else there to tell you if it's right or wrong.
Yeah, so I want to talk a little bit about your debut novel, Number One Chinese Restaurant. Yeah. So like, was that the first novel that you wrote like during like your college days, and then you like queried and got an agent, or did you query with a different manuscript? Mm-hmm. Like how long did it take you to get your debut novel out?
Yeah, I mean, I wrote the novel during my MFA program, so the graduate program that I went to when I finished college, and that was in Michigan. And it was like a 3-year program, and it just so happened that I got a summer job working at a Chinese restaurant similar to the one in my book the summer before I went into that program. And suddenly I had, you know, my subject matter. But before that point, I think I was working on a different novel that was just about two families that keep running into each other at the beach. So like definitely like a dead end novel there. I'm really lucky that I happened to just grab this job. And it was such a unique environment. And the people who had worked there for like 20, 30 years had their own kind of family culture. And I just was so much more interested in that. So I dropped the you know, previous novel and started this one. And then in terms of querying agents, the MFA program does bring agents in, which is like a really great, you know, networking option. But how I found my agent was in college, I had a creative writing professor, Emin White, and he put me in contact with a foreign rights person at an agency who was trying to break into agenting. He's like, you guys are both at the start of your careers. You could help each other out. And then that person, Rach, who was incredibly supportive, she decided that she wanted to move back to her home country of Australia. And feeling that she was leaving me a little bit in the lurch, she was like, you know what? I have this fantastic agent mentor, Adam. Why don't I set you guys up as you're also querying other people that you've met through your MFA? So again, it just like comes down to that theme of the right people at the right time putting me in contact with like the next step.
Yeah. And, you know, it's been 8 years since your debut book was released. And coincidentally, like, there's like an 8-year time span in your sophomore novel. So I thought that was like really interesting.
Yes.
How do you think you have grown as a writer in like that 8-year span? Because obviously a sophomore slump is a thing in the publishing world. So I'm like wondering what your experience was like during this long period of time.
Yeah, I'm so glad that you picked up on the fact that the book took as long to write as the amount of time that passes in it. Like maybe my next book, I'll just try and have it happen in a summer or something like that. Because that's what happened with Number One Chinese Restaurant. And I wrote that in 3 years, which is a pretty fast turnaround. And I think it was because it was just, you know, 3 months time that I had to stay with these characters. So I didn't have to go as deep with each of them. So I think that was the first big learning curve, was writing characters that I then have to see grow up and mature and change in interesting but believable ways, and figuring out like what to put in their path to force that soul evolution. And I think what was also really useful for me to learn between my first and the second book was, I think I've always been really interested in character and character motivation, like really asking why and trying to make things as realistic as possible psychologically. But what I can lose out on is the kind of the fun and joy of fiction, just the fact that it's not real life. You can make anything happen, even if you're writing realistic, grounded fiction. And so with the second book, I started asking more of like, why not? Like, what could I do that would be like fun and unexpected, still believable, but like elevated or exaggerated. And I definitely think, you know, not to spoil anything, but the ending of my second novel is something I could not have written 8 years ago, because I wouldn't have been in that space of what can I do with my fiction that creates a world that we want to live in.
You know, for our listeners out there who are unfamiliar with your sophomore novel, can you give us like a short description of what it's about?
Yeah, absolutely. So Bad Asians is, it follows a group of childhood best friends who graduate, unfortunately, into the 2008 recession. And that means that they are unemployed and they have to move back in with their parents in their hyper-competitive Chinese-American community of North Potomac, Maryland. And it's at this low point in their lives when their former classmate, and I guess you would say like frenemy, Grace Lee, she ends up dropping out of Harvard Law School. And previously, Grace had been kind of like the golden child of this community, like the standard that these friends have been measured against their entire lives by their parents. But now Grace has dropped out. She's like even more of like a loser than they are. And she says that she wants to become a filmmaker and create this documentary about the recession. She wants these friends to be the stars of that documentary. And so against all odds, this documentary ends up becoming one of the first viral videos of the YouTube era, and it skyrockets Grace to YouTube fame and the friend group, unfortunately, to more of like a notoriety, because in the documentary, they end up coming across as these big caricatures of, you know, Asian stereotypes, and also kind of the worst versions of themselves. It's sort of like, imagine, you know, your venting sessions about your friends being put online for all the strangers in the world to see. And that's kind of like the nightmare that they're living through. And the book then follows their lives for the next 8 or so years as they continue to see the fallout of this video on their careers and their relationships and their senses of self.
So I'm like curious, like what made you want to set the book in the early days of YouTube and social media? And how do you think social media and virality impacts how we navigate friendships?
So the funny thing is that I didn't set out to write a book set in the recession, set in the 2000s. I knew that I wanted to write about a group of friends who had known each other since childhood. And I just kept kind of like racking my brain when I was just starting out of like, what would cause these friends to always be hanging out? Like they're not in school anymore. They're in their 20s. So like, why aren't they at work? And that's when it hit me. I was like, oh, of course, they graduate into the recession. So they're kind of like regressed back into childhood in some ways. And they now have this kind of opportunity to be in each other's basements all the time, which is what I wanted to write about. And then it just so happened, once I realized that their frenemy was going to come back into town, she was going to make a documentary about them, I started to think like, okay, what could this documentary be that would like really ruin their lives? And again, as I was thinking about that time period, that's when it hit me that that was also like the rise of social media and internet fame. And so, again, that just clicked into place. And I knew from there, like, okay, that's the plot. And so I think that to your second question about, you know, how does social media and virality kind of affect our friendships today? I think that there is something interesting about how the internet, maybe for me, what it ends up doing that can feel really unnatural is that it makes these otherwise really private and intimate moments so public. And that can be both why we can feel really connected to people we don't know on the internet, but also why we might feel like surveillanced, like that there's like a surveillance system almost around our actions online. So I think that the effect on relationships is that we both feel closer than ever, but also maybe more exposed than ever. And that's kind of hot and cold extremes makes it hard to really know where we stand with each other, because there's this self-consciousness that I think being the possibility of being online all the time brings. And the self-consciousness means that you're never really with another person. You're always kind of with the person while looking at yourself with the person.
Yeah. And I also think there's like some level of performance to the friendship as well, because everybody is watching. Like you said, it's like being on surveillance. And I mean, I wasn't on MySpace when it was popular, but I heard that there was like a top eight and you had to like rank your friends and people could see that in public. And I was like, that must have cost a lot of friendships back in the day.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, like social media has definitely changed the way we connect to people or stay connected to people, right? Because like, yeah, I remember in the early days, like it was Friendster first, then Facebook, then MySpace. And then I remember there's a big hubbub, I think it was like 2008-ish, where Facebook decided to open up their membership to high school.
That's right.
And it's, we were like, we don't want those MySpace people on Facebook. what are you talking about? It's going to be all chaotic. But I think definitely it was interesting to go back to those days. Like reading your book, I thought a lot about Asian American classics that I read in, like, you know, my Asian American lit class, you know, Joy Luck Club, Woman Warrior.
Right.
And, you know, those stories, there's a lot of overlap with your book. You know, they're about relationships between a friend group and their parents and how the dynamics of the parent group affects the kids, right? And how they relate to each other. And I was just thinking, like, because I am, like I mentioned, like contemporary to the characters in your book, like, I graduated a little bit earlier. I graduated college in 2006, but was still caught up in the whole recession in 2008, and definitely had a lot of friends who, like, you know, they went to law school, couldn't find a firm job, or they got laid off because of the recession. Right. And we all had to move home. Like that was just just a common experience for all of us. And, you know, especially for us who grew up, you know, as early millennials, children of immigrants, kind of doing all the right things according to what our parents wanted us to do to be successful, you know, go to a good college, find a good job, get good grades. And all of a sudden, like, that future, that potential, right, is taken from us. That was a very, like, I definitely felt that, like, sense of loss with your characters. Reading your book definitely made me, is this how, like, the Asian American boomers felt when they read Joy Luck Club in, like, the 90s, right? Like, oh, finally, here's, like, because I read those books, and while I do relate to a lot of, like, the cultural things, like, those characters were not, like, I did not live those experiences, whereas your characters, I feel like I did live those experiences, even though, you know, I grew up in the San Gabriel Valley, so a different Asian enclave than North Potomac, but definitely the same, like, you know, we weren't worried about, like, our Asian-ness. We didn't grow up thinking about that, but we grew up thinking about, like, how do we get to a good call? How do we, like, so-and-so has a 4.0, I need to beat that person, right?
No, absolutely. And I love that you've picked up on the fact that it's set in an enclave means that, you know, and I grew up in North Potomac, and I think that it's such a joy to have a childhood that didn't overlap with coming to terms with being in, like, a minority in America, that I could push that off a couple of years later and just have, like, a normal childhood and be around people who looked like me and had my culture, while also people who didn't and didn't have my culture. It was a lot more diverse when I was growing up there than what I ended up, the neighborhoods that I ended up going to after.
Speaking of, like, enclave, like, your book begins with an illustrated map of the neighborhood that your main characters grew up in. And you mentioned that you grew up in an enclave as well. Like, why did you decide to include a map in the beginning of your book? Like, were you the one who drew that, or did you, like, commission someone to draw that after you finished the book?
Yeah, I love the map because I actually was inspired by my first book, because I tend to write these, like, large cast of characters. I like to include a character list just so that people don't get lost as they're getting into the book. And with my first book, there was a family tree that was on a zodiac placemat because it was set in a Chinese restaurant. And so this time around, I was trying to think of, you know, what would be a character list illustration that would be evocative of what the book is about. And I thought about some of my childhood books, which would take place in a neighborhood, and they would include a map with all the little landmarks of where everybody lived. And so I wanted to recreate that, and I pitched the idea to my publisher, and they immediately loved it. And they found an illustrator, a freelance illustrator. Her name is Laura Maestro Hartman, and she did this amazing job with all these little details, like the squirrels and the people on the swings and the geese. And I sent her a screenshot of my childhood neighborhood, so that she could illustrate it. And some things are flipped, but it's basically my neighborhood.
Yeah, it's like, it was like so like weird to me, like because I'm so used to seeing maps for fantasy novels. Yeah. That, like, because it's a contemporary novel, I was just like, oh, this is like a very suburban town. Like you see townhomes and cul-de-sacs and like the shortcut that the characters take when they're like in school. And I was like, wow, okay. Like their world was really small, but you did a really good job capturing like how big that world was when they were children. So like moving on, like Grace Lee's documentary that she makes on her friends / frenemies, it's called Bad Asian. And I think that term is pretty loaded for a lot of Asian Americans. And it probably means something else now because like I feel like the Asian American diaspora experience has really expanded. But can you share your personal definition of like what constitutes a bad Asian in this book, in this time period?
Yeah. No, I definitely feel like it is a phrase that is tied to this time period. And it's not one that I think is really used as much anymore. Because I did ask my Gen Z cousins and they were like, we've never heard of that before. So it is like now fully out of date. But the definition actually shows up in the viral video. And what the definition is it's a term for any Asian American who doesn't fit their stereotype. And this is my favorite part of the definition. It's often used by other Asian Americans. And I always, you know, as I was thinking about the title and whether or not this would be the right fit, I remembered that this was a term that was used to kind of, you know, teasingly correct behavior that was outside the norm. So like if you didn't like boba, for example, you were bad Asian. But at the same time, you know, interestingly, I think it was a term that you could then reuse almost like as a badge of courage for yourself. You call yourself a bad Asian. So like, you know, the fact of maybe pursuing like an artistic career would make me a bad Asian. And I could call myself that proudly. And I think the final thing that made it really interesting is that it's a term that I remember, you know, you could kind of say it casually as an Asian American, but I think anyone outside of that community would be pretty uncomfortable using it. And so I also like that it was a phrase that just felt differently depending on whether you were inside or outside.
Yeah, it was always interesting to me how like the idea of a good Asian became so ubiquitous. Like everyone knows like the stereotype of good Asian, and that has to do with like, the modern minority myth and all that. And there's a time, especially in that time period, where Asian Americans latched onto the idea of being bad Asians, of being not part of the norm. Like, oh, I'm bad at math, I'm a bad Asian, but that means I'm good at other things. Or like, you know, this was the time when, and I never watched it, but like you couldn't get away from the Glee episode Asian F and everyone like kind of going crazy over that, right?
Oh my God, you just like awoke some memories.
I'm just thinking about like, when did Better Luck Tomorrow come out? That was like in the early 2000s, right? That was like the first film that like kind of showed the opposite of like the model minority. Like, oh, like Asian American boys can be, you know, bad boys too and not follow their parents' expectations.
Yeah.
But I feel like, like the term bad Asians, it doesn't really exist anymore in like the Gen Z, Gen Alpha vernacular because they've just seen so much representation. And I feel like there's been like so much conversation on, you know, like why model minority is harmful and how it doesn't encompass the entire diaspora. Because obviously, like, it's different if you're like Chinese American and you have, and you're from like middle class background versus if you were like Filipino American, for example, and you, you know, are from like a lower income bracket. So I feel like we've had that conversation to nauseam. And I feel like the younger generation now are just like, bad Asian, what does that mean? Like, I've never heard of it.
I feel like it still exists though. And like, this is actually a plot point in your novel, Lillian, where like, there's still a certain way people want Asian Americans to act, especially within the community, where you have to support everything 100%. You have to like not talk about our dirty laundry. And if you do, then you become...
You're canceled.
Yeah. Right? Like, there's still some policing going on, like what makes a good Asian and what makes a bad Asian, for sure.
That reminds me, you included fictitious articles and headlines about Grace and her film Bad Asians throughout your book. And I thought it was so funny because... like throughout, like while reading your book, it's in third person. like you get into the heads of all these characters and you like see how, you know, they're reacting to what's the drama that's happening around them. But with these articles, it's like you're seeing it from an outsized point of view. You're seeing it from like a community's point of view. Like, how does the Asian American community is reacting to Grace Lee's comment about bad Asians and like how it has impacted the community. So like, what was it like writing those standalone articles between, you know, the POVs of your characters?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I, you know, didn't, again, like set out to write these articles. But then once Grace became this public persona and became more and more distant, as like, it was harder for the characters to access her as a person once she became a public persona. And similarly, like as a writer, I also kind of in some ways lost my grasp on who Grace was once she became that famous. And so the newspaper articles became this way for me to still be able to track what she was up to and get a little bit of her interiority while also having this necessary distance, because ultimately I was writing more from the perspective of the friend group. And so the fact that they didn't really know Grace outside of her stardom meant that in some ways I also was a little bit in the dark. And I ended up really enjoying writing the newspaper articles because I could just pull up like old BuzzFeed articles and just get back into that voice. And then the New York Times profile, like I read a bunch of Taffy Brodesser Ackner's profiles, which were fantastic. And I just love being able to mimic that journalistic voice where they're sort of like, it's objective, but not really. There's still like an obvious point of view that's going on. And I thought also that it was a nice nod to the theme of like public versus private, because you basically could see like the behind the scenes of everything that's happening actually in real life to the characters. And then what's summarized in the newspaper article is such a different perspective on it. And I really liked being able to give the reader both experiences.
I thought you did a really good job with capturing like the voice of journalistic writing, because I just like cackled. Maybe it's because like I worked as a journalist, but I was just like, oh, describing what Grace was wearing and like the vibe of the bars that they were going. What was she drinking? Like how... Like, what were other people doing? And it was like, it's like writing a screenplay, you know, you're like setting the moods, like describing the scene. And I was like, oh, wow, this is like, I wonder if Lillian wrote for like the New York Times and like Dundee's profiles, because she wrote them really well.
Thank you. Just a reader, just a fan.
I really loved it. And I hope this is not like spoiling anything, but like your very last article ends with a paywall.
Yes.
Yeah. And I was like, oh, yeah, because it's 2016. Everyone started monetizing this stuff.
Yeah. Oh, my God. I love that. Yeah. You picked that up. It was, yes. I remember the moment that the paywall came into being and just like, oh. And back when you used to get like 9 out of 10 articles for free.
Yeah.
Now we can't even get one. It's,
I know.
It's brutal out there.
It's like one per month.
I do remember when. I do remember when like BuzzFeed was like very aggressive with getting stories, and I just like feel like that's kind of died out too. BuzzFeed, like what happened to you?
I know. And I did like that you could also, there was the same journalist across all the articles, so you kind of see her you know, her career developing over time as well.
Yeah, I noticed that too. I was like, oh, the BuzzFeed writer, like her career has grown. She's gone to the New York Times. Like she's a big timer now.
Yeah.
Good for her.
Yeah, you do such a good job creating this world and like this friend group that we follow from 2008 to 2016. And each with their own essentially parental baggage, right? They're all a certain way because the way their parents raised them and also the way that they interact with each other. And I love that you kind of see them through like these 8 years from like their early 20s to I think they're 30 at the end of the book. And the fact that like, yeah, like when you're younger, everything is just so intense and like, you know, your frontal lobe's not fully formed. So, you know, you're not mature. And then once you're 30, that's when you're actually ready to like understand things, think things more clearly. And you kind of just realize, like, a lot of my, like, my favorite Asian American stories, everyone gets to the point where they realize that their parents were also young when they were kids.
Right.
And maybe were also didn't have their frontal lobes totally developed. Right. Yeah. And so, like, I love that you followed this trajectory of these four friends. Like, did you have these four friends, like, in their, like, their personalities, like, fully cooked when you started writing? Or did they, like, how did you develop your main characters?
Yeah. I mean, I did have this image going into the book of a group of four friends around a computer in a basement. Like, that was sort of the foundational image for me. And then it was just a question of, like, well, who are these people and who are they to each other? And I would say that they kind of came into existence in the same order that the chapters are structured. So it goes Diana, Justin, Errol, and Vivian. And that's pretty much the order that I got to know them. So Diana came first, and that makes sense to me because Diana is, like, she is aggressive, assertive. She is, like, the leader of the group, and having her voice, which is so, like, she says exactly what she's thinking. There's no subterfuge about her. That actually makes a very easy character to write. And so she came first, and then Justin came in as this emotional weight that I needed in the book when I got to write about him and his relationship with his single mother and how much he worries for her and how much he keeps kind of locked up inside himself and comes across to his friends as just this sort of, like, quiet meathead almost. I realized that, you know, as long as this book was going to take me to write, which at the time I didn't know was going to be 8 years, but I knew that Justin was going to be my reason for finishing because I wanted to understand his emotional journey. And then the really weird thing was that Errol and Vivian initially were brother and sister. And then,
yeah.
I know. And then the fact that they're in, like, a romantic relationship in the book, but one that is sort of, you know, I think at one point Errol compares kissing Vivian to, like, it's like kissing my sister. Like, they're so, they've known each other for such a long time that even their romantic relationship feels almost like familial. I think that is definitely influenced by the fact that they were actually siblings to begin with. But I would say those were how I kind of came to know all of them. And then Grace being the fifth mysterious character, you know, she doesn't get her own perspective chapter until after all of theirs. And it's one in which, you know, she's 12, 13 years old. So Grace was definitely the hardest to get to know. But again, I think that was by design since she is always put on this pedestal and she is kind of unknowable to the others until she's ultimately humanized by the very end.
Yeah, it sounded like from the get-go, you're like, oh, okay, this book is going to be about four friends and them growing up during this time. And, you know, like, I feel like we read a lot of books, we consume a lot of media about, like, romantic heartbreaks and fallouts. And, you know, it's very rare to see, like, a whole book dedicated on, like, a trajectory of a friendship and why, like, why people break up and how that can be so painful and affect you, like, years on. And I just want to hear your opinion on, like, why do you think friendship breakups are often more painful than romantic ones? And like, and also, like, your opinion on, like, seeing that more in media.
Yeah, I am so glad that you brought up friendship breakups, because I think that was the other side of the coin of what I wanted to write about, was not just childhood friend groups, but then the breakup that ensues. Because definitely from my own personal experience, my friendship breakups are way more painful than I have thought about them for much longer. And in telling people about what this book is, I've come to realize that I'm definitely not alone there. And that question that you asked of, like, why are they more painful is such a good one, because, you know, I had a lot of theories going into writing this book. You know, there's maybe the sense that friends are supposed to be forever, and so the end feels very unexpected. There's maybe also the fact that friends are you get to choose your friends, unlike family. And so the fact of getting to choose to unfriend feels like also that much more extreme. And then I also got this sense from talking to people that there is a shame that comes with a friend breakup where you don't really want to talk about it, because unlike a romantic relationship where it's like, okay, like, yeah, you're not a match, you're not compatible, it's not your fault. With friendships breaking up, it feels like it is a comment on your character, like you're not a good friend. There's something wrong with the way that you related to this person. And so there's maybe some embarrassment about sharing that because it might reveal that, you know, there's something wrong about you. But I think ultimately what I came to realize from writing this, and I actually ended up interviewing a lot of people about their friend breakups, and the experience of hearing people talk about their friend breakups and the pain of it healed a lot of my own pain and actually causes me now to think a lot less about those friend breakups. I really do think that there just wasn't space to talk. And so you suffered in silence and you suffered alone. And just knowing that a lot of other people also have struggled with friendships and friend breakups means that you can kind of work through the pain knowing that it's not unique to your experience and you're not like a freak for feeling this way.
Yeah. I also really love that your book features, you know, everyone in your, like all your main characters are essentially like recovering overachievers. Like
yeah.
They, you know,
yes.
What made you want to tell a story about four characters who had such lofty goals and then end up kind of settling in like a more comfortable like space for themselves, like mm-hmm. later on in life? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that I was really drawn to writing about the kind of burnt out overachiever because it did feel like growing up that it wasn't just an Asian experience. It felt like there were a lot of people who felt that there was this success checklist of get good grades, good college, and then everything else will just fall into place. And I guess if you really boiled it down, it is what the American dream is promising you, is that if you work hard, you will get the exact reward that you deserve. And I really wanted to write about the disillusionment with that dream, and especially with the time period that I was writing about and the time period of what my characters are in with their early 20s. It's like a coming of age tale, not just for the characters, but I think for Americans as we lost our innocence around these institutions like banks, and also lost our innocence around the internet and ended up, you know, becoming necessarily more jaded, more mature, more cynical about these things. And I really wanted to capture both the loss of that innocence, but also the innocence itself, how we did used to feel that there was a path to happiness that was simple, and that there was also a sense of the internet as being like a private room with all your friends. You just don't have to be in that room like physically together. I didn't want us to lose touch with how hopeful we used to be, because I think that hope can be a guidepost to, you know, maybe what we can shape the internet back into being. Because there was a time where it was really, really fun. And I remember being on the internet together in a person's basement. Like it used to be a social, an actually social thing where you weren't separated in different rooms. You would like gather together to be on the internet together.
Yeah, we would watch Wong Fu videos together. We would play.
Yeah.
Like,
I think it's really funny that I'm sure this trend has passed now, but like there was like a 2016 nostalgia trend, yes, on social, yes, media, like fairly recently. And I just thought that was really funny because, you know, like obviously now we are in the worst timeline and anything that was like 10 years ago seems like such simpler times. Like everything was like more positive. But like for us who kind of like lived through that as adults, we're like, no, actually, we were way more optimistic and the internet was way better before 2016.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
Like, I wonder if like that 2016 nostalgia is like mostly from people who were teenagers at that time. And
yeah,
and that's why it was so special to them. And I guess like being a teenager, like everything feels so intense and everything feels like brighter, I guess.
Right.
And I guess that's why it was like popular. I mean, I think every generation has like their own 2016 nostalgia.
Yeah. I mean, it'd be 2008 for our generation, right? Leading up to the crisis. I think it's just like 2016. I do appreciate your, I did like that your book ended right before fall of 2016 when,
right,
when
I was like, we don't talk about that.
We don't talk about that.
But like, you know, thinking back on like 2016, like we were it was a really, like, there was a lot of optimism, right? We were coming off of, you know, the Obama years. We were like looking forward, and it was, none of us had any idea what was to come, right? Like, we were all blindsided.
Yeah. And similarly, like, you know, 2008, before the recession, there was also, again, that sense of like extreme hope and excitement, and then the crash of that. So it does seem like we're kind of always coming of age, which, and I think there is something hopeful about that, right? That we never end up becoming so jaded as to stop being surprised when things get worse.
Yeah, I mean, as millennials, we have lived through how many recessions now, and how many life-changing events. We, like, we're just like, it will get better. We will soldier on. In one of your later chapters, you wrote, "What a strange concept, turning destruction into a place worth revisiting." And since we're talking about nostalgia, I thought this was a good place to bring it up. As much as the Bad Asians video leads the friend group to break up, it's also a reason for them to come back together again, like years later. What is it about this documentary that just makes them feel like it's worth reconnecting and reconciling, or at least a chance at reconciling?
Yeah. I mean, you guys are just picking up on like my favorite parts of the book. So like, thank you for reading it as well as you did. Yeah. I, was really drawn to this idea of, you know, cause there are friendship breakups where it's more of like a slow ghosting and there's no real conflict. And I feel like with those ends, you know, there isn't that draw to you know, come back because there's nothing to really apologize for. Like, truly, you guys just grew apart. But then the friendship breakups where it's just like a huge, like, knockout, drag out fight. Those are the ones that I feel like can loom larger in your memory. But in doing so, it actually creates its own kind of opening for a reunion. And I was also really interested in how oftentimes it takes an external event to allow for a friendship to repair itself. Like, I had seen that people were able to repair their friendship because they both happened to be going to the same wedding or the same funeral or a college reunion. And it was a chance to come back together without the pressure and the vulnerability of like, I want to get back together again, but just like, oh, we happen to be in the same room and we're different people. Maybe we've both gotten therapy. And the thing that made us work is still there, but maybe the thing that damaged us no longer is. So it allows for the kind of basically for people to almost like ricochet back into each other's lives. And so with the viral video, I like that it combined those two elements of like what can allow for a friendship breakup to become a reunion and a repair. It was both this huge argument that keeps in some ways the wound open, and something that you want to revisit, whether you want to or not. So you can't really ever forget the friend and what they meant to you and what you did to each other. And then also it's this external public thing. People keep bringing this video back to their lives and forcing them back together again. So it's like a kind of fate that forces them back into a repair.
Yeah, it's almost like a time capsule in a way, but not the greatest feeling sometimes.
Yeah.
I mean, everyone is a sum total of their, all their experience, right? Good and bad. Mm-hmm. And, you know, some people just loom larger than others. And I feel like your book definitely captures that idea of like, you know, I still keep in touch with my oldest friends, right? Because again, I moved home after college and all that.
Right,
But, you know, those are friendships that even if we haven't talked to each other in a while, like there's something comfortable about knowing that like they'll at least give me a minute of their time if I'm around.
Yeah, I love that. And I think to combine that with the time capsule analogy from earlier, I do feel like people from your past allow you to access parts of yourself that you can't without them. They're like the key to your time capsule. And I definitely regress when I'm with my friends from the different eras of my life. And I love that because I feel like I can be that person again. And it reminds me that that person is always still part of who I am, even if I don't recognize them in pictures anymore.
Yeah.
I do feel like childhood friendships, like teen friendships, mm-hmm. they're very different from like the friends you make in college and also like at your workplace. I don't know if it's because it's like there's like a hyper competitiveness or, you know, you're always trying to like outdo each other at work, get that promotion, get that bonus. And in like college, in college, it's like, well, I want to be a different person than who I was in high school. So I don't know. There's just like this comfort of being with your older friends who kind of knew all these different versions of you as you were growing up.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
All right. Lillian, you, I feel like you have a talent for writing just like severe Asian parents in both your books, really. Yeah. How did you discover about this like kind of latent talent to like write like the just the most like triggering Asian parents in your books?
So like, of course, my mom has read both of my books and she has asked me both times, like, is she the inspiration for any of these characters? And I'm like, no, 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 your mother was. So I would say that like my family is like very funny, very unfiltered. Like our kind of family motto is like, if it's true, you get to say it no matter how mean it is. Or if it's funny, you get to say it no matter how mean it is. But I would definitely say like the matriarch of my family, my grandmother who's now passed away, was like the harshest, most ferocious person that I knew. And channeling just the way that she would kind of break a person down, in some ways, I think she like speaks through me. And I think that must be where I get it from, because it is just like such a different level of intensity. Like I don't, have you guys both seen Succession?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so like that's supposed to be like really exaggerated and elevated way of like talking to each other. And like that's just normal in an Asian family. So I think that just being steeped in it and my parents' friends and my friends' parents, like there is this sort of like common language of roasting each other.
Yeah. It's funny you bring up Succession, because I was thinking like if this was the parent story, like every single character in your novel would be failed children. Like they would just be like
But I
appreciate that your novel, you know, makes heroes of the failed children. Like we're not failures after all, right?
That's so funny, because like after my mom read Bad Asians, she called me up and she was like, why can't you ever write about hot rich people? Like, why do you always write about losers? And I was like, I like the losers, mom. I'm a loser. So yeah, totally.
Most people
totally
are losers. Not all of us can be hot rich people. That's a minority.
Yeah, exactly. But my third book is called Hot Rich People, so look out for that.
Oh, okay. I was going to ask you, since we're at like towards the end of our interview, and thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us. What, like, do you have anything else that you are working on right now? Like you said, your third book might be called Hot Rich People. Is that an actual thing that you're working on?
So I found that like after, you know, finishing one book and starting another, that there's like a period of time where I'm writing, but I don't know exactly what the shape of the book will be. But a lot of the themes that are interesting to me carry through, and as it kind of like reincarnates into different plots and characters. So right now, at least, like the questions that I seem to be interested in are around like death and the afterlife and ambition, and like how much connection we have to like our ancestors and how much effect they have on our lives from the afterlife. So I think like that's an area that I'm interested in, but we'll see what it ends up becoming. And then I'm also working to, you know, adapt Bad Asians for film and see if there's any, you know, space to go there, because I would love to be able to see a book that's so much about video actually be visual. So those are kind of the two areas that I'm working on right now.
I want to read both. I want to watch and read both of those things.
Like I was thinking like how Bad Asians would be a great source material for like a TV series, because you have like such developed characters, and of course like having flashbacks, I'm like, oh, that would be like cool to see like present day, to like cut back to like 2008 and like that styling, and like it would be like so great to see. I hope it comes into fruition. Like, very best luck to you on that.
Yeah,
thank you.
You do play with time a lot in your book. Like, it's a lot of flashbacks, a lot of like things you put off till later, the flashback too. I'm just curious, like, how did you keep it all straight in your head? Like, did you have a lot of help from like an editor to like kind of make sure things, make sure everything made
sense? Did you have like a board with like red string?
Yeah, like that meme.
Yeah.
So weirdly enough, I don't think I had to map anything out. The main thing that I had to keep track of was like how old each of the characters were at each year and what like grade they were in and make sure that was consistent. So I have like a notes app that is basically just like they're in fourth grade, they're it's this year and so on and so forth. And they're each this age. And I had to figure out their birthdays and then I had to make it match them astrologically and their personality.
Yeah.
Amazing.
I'm sure your copy editors helped a lot with keeping track of how old everyone was and like actually this thing didn't come out until like a year later. Yeah.
Yes, they definitely did. Like, because I think at one point I had people like texting on the subway and they're just like, there was no Wi-Fi or like data on the subway until this age. And I was like, oh, damn it. Like that ruins an entire plot point. I had to like completely rewrite something because of that. But yeah, I would say that like in terms of mapping things out and mapping characters out, that comes pretty innately. But then like actually coming up with a plot that is a big enough has like a big enough effect is like my weakness and the thing that I will always spend the most time on.
Yeah. Well, Lillian, thank you so much for joining us on Books of Love to chat about your newest book. Congratulations on the launch and also Happy New Year. Happy New Year and happy book launch to you. And yeah, thanks for joining us.
Such a pleasure to be here.
And that was Lillian Lee. Her sophomore novel, Bad Asians, is available now at booksellers everywhere, including, as always, the Books & Boba bookstore, where all purchases support not only us here at Books & Boba, but also your local bookstore. So if you enjoyed our conversation with Lillian and want to pick up her newest book, head on over to booksandboba.com and check out our bookshop link. As always, thanks to everyone who has bought a book through our bookstore and supported us here at Books & Boba. All right. Well, before we call an episode, Reba, can you remind us what book we're reading this month for Book Club?
Yeah, so we are reading Zen Cho's Romance Behind Frenemy Lines. It is a rivals to lovers romance that's about two lawyers who kind of had been in awkward situations and now have to work together and also pretend that they're in a relationship to get one of their bosses to stop hitting on them. So, full of shenanigans.
Yeah, lots of great rom-com shenanigans. It takes place in London, features a South Asian, East Asian relationship, and just a lot of fun. Like, I've been a big fan of Zen Cho's works ever since reading Source of the Crown for this book club, as well as her follow-up on The True Queen, and it's been a lot of fun seeing, you know, her style of writing in a more contemporary setting. So, really excited to chat with you about this at the end of the month. And don't forget, if you are a Patreon supporter, we are reading along and discussing the book on our Discord server. So be sure to check out the Discord thread for the reading schedule. But yeah, that'll do it for this episode of Books & Boba. Thank you once again to Lillian Lee for joining us to talk about her latest book, Bad Asians. And we'll see you all next time. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Books & Boba. This podcast was hosted by Marvin Yue and Mi Ryu and edited and produced by Marvin Yue. Follow the book club on Twitter and Instagram by going to @booksandboba and engage with us on Goodreads on our Goodreads group. You can also check out past episodes of the podcast by going to booksandboba.com and by subscribing to us on your favorite podcast app. Don't forget, you can support Books & Boba and Asian American authors by purchasing books at our bookshop.org account. Check out the link in our show notes and also at booksandboba.com. Books & Boba is a proud member of the Potluck Podcast Collective, a collective of Asian American hosted podcasts featuring unique voices and stories from the Asian diaspora. Learn more about the collective and check out our fellow Potluck shows by visiting the website podcastpotluck.com. Thanks for listening.
Hungry for spicy food and even hotter conversations? Craving community and authentic storytelling? Then join the table. This is Minor Legends, a new comedy fiction podcast supported by Potluck. Pull up every week with me, Angela Wong Carbone, and follow the stories of me and my friends as we serve up tasty tales of what it means to be Asian American at our weekly dinner hang. If you enjoy deep dishing on absurd stereotypes like tiger moms who tutor your dating game rather than grades, the insanity of your parents' immigration story, to the legend of that one good Asian cousin you can never live up to, then pull up a seat and grab a plate. Featuring dinner guests like Ronnie Chang, Brian Park, Usama Siddiqui, Celia Au, Perry Young, Supriya Ganesh, and more. It's a tasty rotation that'll leave you belly laughing and steeped in relatable and spicy conversations. Can you take the heat? Listen now for free wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, sports fans. Welcome to Asians in Hockey. You may not realize it, but there's a rich history of Asians and AAPI folks who have contributed to the legacy of the greatest game on ice. From classic legends like Julie Chu and Robin Bawa, to current greats like Lia Lum and Nick Suzuki, and even rising stars like Akane Shiga and Jason Robertson. We'll cover their stories, celebrate their accomplishments, and learn about their impact on the sport of hockey. I'm Nate Nakao, former Beer League player, occasional youth hockey coach, and longtime hockey fan, and I'll be your host as we take a look at the rise of Asians in hockey. Subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Pocket Casts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Part of the Potluck Podcast Collective.